This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Ladies and gentlemen, the Amazon is burning. The Brazilian rainforest is experiencing a record number of fires this year, an 83% increase over 2018. 70,000 fires. How do you set them that fast? 70,000 have blocked out the sun for thousands of miles, covering cities like Sao Paulo in a dark cloud. Environmental agencies and researchers suspect the fires have been set by people, cattle ranchers and loggers perhaps, who are looking to clear the land to grow cash crops. And they've been encouraged to do so by Brazilian President Bolsonaro, who campaigned on a promise to help Brazil's economy by exploring the Amazon's economic potential. Joining us to tell us about this unprecedented burning of the Amazon rainforest, as well as other short subjects in science, is Ryan Mandelbaum, science writer for Gizmodo. Welcome back, Ryan.
It's good to be back, Ira.
Let's talk about the Amazon. What's happening there right now?
So the Amazon is burning at an alarming rate. We're talking maybe a soccer pitch-sized area every few minutes. 82% more fires than last year. This is more extreme than sort of 2016, which was an extreme case. And as far as we know, it is due to sort of business because of clearing of the land and Bolsonaro's government, Brazil's new president, mm-hmm. Bolsonaro is sort of scaling back the enforcement of the illegal burning of the forest, and it is encouraging businesses to then go in and then start clearing what is essentially the lungs of the planet.
It's amazing. It's scary, isn't it?
I mean, I lose sleep over it. This is as bad as it gets.
Mm-hmm. And of course, this has everything to do with climate change, too, doesn't it?
That's right. I mean, this is, the Amazon is responsible for taking carbon out of the atmosphere. It's responsible for putting oxygen back into the atmosphere. And this is the kind of thing that, if we lose the Amazon, we're losing a vital piece of the fight against climate change.
Mm-hmm. I know you love to talk about astrophysics. I know you feel like I do that you got to talk about the Amazon because it is life on Earth. But let's talk about physics for a little bit. Let's talk about LIGO scientists who are reporting that they have detected what they think is a black hole colliding with a neutron star. Why is that a big deal?
Well, so LIGO's already detected the evidence of two black holes colliding, and that was a huge deal because of the gravitational waves that we found here on Earth. And then shortly after, they discovered two neutron stars colliding, where a neutron star is a dead star about the diameter of a city that's even heavier than the sun. And so this is the completing that trifecta. So we've got two black holes, two neutron stars, and now a black hole and a neutron star. And it's exciting to see new things. And this again, the detection is based on the gravitational waves, and it's more stuff coming from LIGO.
Isn't that fun?
Yeah, it's great. I mean, I like this.
Yeah, it's a fun thing to think about. What for people who don't remember what a neutron star is? What is a neutron star?
Right. So it's a super dense object. It's about the same size as like Brooklyn across, but then it's as massive as the sun. So it's just mind-boggling to think about these things existing. But it's the corpse of a star that's died.
That's a good way to put it. And there must be many of these going on, and this might be just the first one.
So there actually has already been a couple of potential detections of this kind of event, and this seems to be one of the strongest ones. But LIGO is now running full steam ahead, so the hope is that we continue to detect these weird kind of events, and then hopefully one day actually see if there's a electromagnetic, a light component to this with our telescopes.
Let's continue on our weird, okay? Because let's talk about chemists actually creating a different kind of carbon.
Ira, you like graphene, right?
I love it.
You love graphene.
Oh, yes.
So I use
it every day.
Every day, right. So graphene is a two-dimensional allotrope of carbon, which just is, it's just carbon. Mm-hmm. And diamond is a three-dimensional network of carbon. So now scientists have created and looked up close at a single-dimensional ring of carbon. So it's just carbon in a ring, 18 carbon atoms. And they, using atomic force microscopy, so they use this microscope with an atomic-sized tip, and they make a precursor molecule, and they knock off the scaffold. And then they have this crazy single-dimensional carbon ring.
People don't realize they can make their own graphene with some scotch tape,
right? Scotch tape.
And a pencil.
Yeah, this is just another. This carbon ring is like another cool kind of carbon, and it's showing all the weird ways that we could make carbon into these different forms. And then, they have these interesting electronic properties. So the hope is maybe these carbon rings will be useful for like a low energy computing.
All right, let's move on to some more, a lot of exciting stuff today. Yeah. The NASA's Europa Clipper mission is moving into the final phase. Remind us about what that mission is about. That's exciting also.
Yeah, so Jupiter's moon Europa has potentially a liquid water ocean underneath, and we know, thanks to the Hubble Space Telescope, that it actually has these plumes of water that it spews into the air over Europa. Now, the hope is that if it has a water ocean, well, then maybe there's some sort of biological stuff going on. Mm. Maybe there's life down there. And if we had a Clipper, we could fly by Europa and maybe either sample the plumes, look at this moon up close, and look if there's any sign of something interesting going on down there.
Mm-hmm. It seems like the search for life is big out there in the solar system these days.
Yeah, I mean, the Earth is only one way we know that life could be formed. Mm-hmm. Maybe there's other. I mean, in the bottom of our own ocean, we have such interesting life forms that rely on the sort of chemistry, the chemical potentials in order to live. And maybe that's happening deep in Europa. Who knows?
And because we know there are some really hardy organisms living right here on Earth that are impervious to all kinds of insults. Maybe they could be out there also, right?
Right. Extremophiles, they call them, right? So they live in the salt. They live in the heat. It's awesome.
Great. Thank you, Ryan Mandelbaum, science writer for Gizmodo.
Thanks, Ira. Always good to be here.
Good to have you back. And now we're going to move on to check in on the state of science.
This is KERA
for WWNO,
St. Louis Public Radio,
Iowa Public Radio News.
Local science stories of national significance. Many states are trying to get more drivers to use electric cars, but here's something we haven't quite figured out yet. How should drivers be charged for a charge? A new law in North Carolina will change how electric charging stations in the state operate to make them more like gas pumps. David Borax is an environment and energy reporter at WFAE in Charlotte, North Carolina. He's here to fill us in. Hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Hello, Ira. How are you?
Fine. Let's talk about this. Before the law, how did the price of electric charging stations work now in North Carolina?
Well, the way it works right now is that owners of electric vehicle charging stations, if they want to get paid for this, they have to charge users by the amount of time it takes to fill up your battery with electricity. And that's a little bit of a problem because not all cars charge at the same speed, and there are lots of variables there.
So there's really so if I have a fast speed charging car, I'll get more electricity in the same time, and that's not equitable, basically.
That's right. And folks who run these charging stations in the industry say it's not fair to charge that way. And that includes Tesla, which is kind of the big guy in the field right now.
Mm-hmm. All right. So how's charging going to work from now on?
Well, the law has in North Carolina and many other states now is changing to allow them to charge by the kilowatt hour. And you could think of that as much the same as charging per gallon of gas, the way it comes out of the pump for your gas guzzler right now. So that should change the picture entirely, and that will be much more lined up with the amount of energy that you use to charge.
So are there any concerns about how well this will work, whether it's going to be rolling out smoothly or not?
Well, there's a lot to be done before we get here in North Carolina. There are a few places around the country that already have charging stations that are metered by the kilowatt hour. But in North Carolina, all the stations up until now have had to operate according to time. And so the owners of these stations now, their next task will be to update their equipment or get new equipment to do this. And then there's the whole question of how much we'll pay for this.
Mm-hmm. So this actually could work for gas stations, let's say, who want to put a charging station in there because they know that there are more Teslas and other cars on the road. I mean, I have one. I'm sure a lot of people are buying them. But they could start to make money from the charging, right?
They could. And actually, it's a great question. Why haven't we seen this yet? Why haven't some of the big gasoline chains put in at least one charging station there?
But now if you give them an incentive that they can make some money, right, and they can charge by the gallon, so to speak, or the kilowatt hour, this is a way for them to make some dough also.
And that's really why North Carolina legislators decided to change the law and why the governor signed the bill. There are a lot of companies lined up to compete in this area, so we're going to see a lot of evolution in the next few years. But we could see separate stations. We could see existing gas stations doing this. And, of course, there's all the places where you find a charger right now, which are everywhere from your grocery store parking lot to your company office garage.
Yeah, I know. I stayed at a hotel recently because I had to travel 200 miles to get there, and I picked that little hotel because they had a charging station right as part of the hotel. I guess that could be more of a trend here because you can not only have gas stations, but you could have hotels that could charge for it.
And some of the companies that are active in the charger space, they're actually selling chargers to anybody who wants to install them. And so it has become popular for some businesses to offer this as an add-on. And oftentimes at these places, it's free. I don't know what you paid at your hotel there, but oftentimes they do that as an extra service, as an add-on. I think we'll more and more begin to see this as a money-making opportunity for people who operate chargers.
Yeah, mine was free. I mean, they actually put their own real Tesla charger in there, a couple of them. And mm-hmm. I mean, that's the way they got people in there. Let's move on to another aspect of this, because you've reported in how there's such a demand for electric cars that North Carolina is reopening its lithium mines.
Yeah, that's right. There's a company that has been looking in western North Carolina at a site that used to be a lithium mine. Back from the 1940s up to the 1980s, there were lithium mines about 30 miles west of Charlotte. And that was at a time when the main uses for lithium were as like an industrial grease, as an additive to ceramics to make them stronger, and everybody's familiar with lithium as an antidepressant drug. But that industry looked elsewhere, to South America and Australia, for lithium, until we got to this point now where everybody has a lithium battery in all their devices and their automobiles. And so that's caused some investors to take a look at these old mines in this area west of Charlotte and begin testing. And there's a company called Piedmont Lithium that I have written about, which is looking at an area that stretches from the tip of one county all the way to the South Carolina border. And they have acquired about 2,200 acres of land or contracts on land. And they foresee about a 25-year supply of lithium here. And they're talking it up as the biggest supply in North America right now of traditional lithium deposits.
Wow, because it is very rare, David. Thank you. Thank you very much. This is interesting stuff. We'll have to have you back soon. Thanks for
taking time.
You're welcome. David Borax, Environment and Energy Reporter at WFAE in Charlotte, North Carolina. We're going to take a break, and after we come back, we're going to talk about birds. You want to talk about birds? Yeah, please give us a call. Our number, 844-724-8255, 844-724-8255. You can also tweet us at SciFry. It's the last chapter of our summer book club. We've been reading the book, The Genius of Birds, and we're going to talk about with The Genius of Birds with Jennifer Ackerman. Ryan Mandelbaum would love to be in on this conversation. We'll be right back after this break. Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Is bird brain a compliment? No, right? I mean, it's you got to say no, because we've long associated that phrase with someone who's not that smart, which makes sense if you go by that old assumption about birds themselves. Small heads, lightweight bodies can't have much room for weighty thoughts, right, if you also want to fly. But if you've been reading our summer book club pick, Jennifer Ackerman's The Genius of Birds, you know there's a lot more going on in the mind of a bird than we used to give them credit for. The famous tool-using crows of New Caledonia, brightly decorated nests of bowerbirds, mockingbirds, amazing memorization and mimicry, and of course, the annual migration over thousands of miles by so many species. Our listeners have been reading the book all summer and sent some observations of smart behavior through our Science Friday Vox Pop app.
Here in New Zealand, we had two little blue penguins trying to make a nest under a sushi shop in Wellington City, and then Waddle in the shop looking for food.
I think a smart animal is an animal who can reach its objective either through communicating with other animals or figuring out a way to communicate with humans, or being resourceful in their ideas and figuring out how to problem solve.
I think every kind of animal knows how to do what it needs to do. So I think that defining smart is, in a way, trying to compare apples to oranges.
Once when I was fishing, I was repeatedly whistling the theme song to the Rifleman television show. After doing it many times, I went silent. Not soon after, I heard a mockingbird repeating back the first few notes repeatedly.
Thank you to Michelle from New Zealand, Morelia from Oregon, Ronnie from Pennsylvania, and Greg from Kentucky for those comments. We're going to spend the rest of the hour celebrating these brilliant birds, and here to help, we've got sci-fi producer and bird book nerd Christy Taylor. Welcome back, Christy.
Hey, Ira.
Nice to have you back. So,
yeah, me too.
You know, I'm a bit sad to be done talking about birds. for this year.
I am too. And, you know, as someone who really loves birds, but I actually don't know much about them individually, I've really loved having an excuse to dig down deep into some of the topics about their brains. We've learned that birds can see in the ultraviolet this last summer, and that the birds that we see are not the birds that birds see, for example. The way songbirds learn to sing has a lot to do with how we learn to talk, all kinds of things like that.
Mm-hmm. And we sent our listeners out looking for birds. I know I was paying closer attention to my backyard feeder this summer, and even though this is the last week for the book club, I feel like my appreciation of birds isn't over. I'm very happy to keep looking for those birds.
Yeah, me too. And thanks to everyone who joined us on our iNaturalist on the iNaturalist app to share some of their cool bird findings. There were people who went out looking and they found some really neat species, kias, grosbeaks. Meanwhile, all I found were pigeons. But as we'll hear soon, pigeons are really, really smart.
That's true. Let me bring in the rest of our bird nerds to talk about that. Let's bring them in right now. Aaron Blaisdell, professor of psychology at UCLA. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, Ira. Thank you for having me here. And hi, Christy.
And Dr. Lauren Readers is a professor of animal behavior and neuroscience at the University of Wisconsin in Madison.
Hi, so, Aaron, I'm going to start with you because we just mentioned pigeons, and you're studying those in particular. How smart is a pigeon?
Well, as the commentators were already savvy in suggesting, it's really tricky to define smart. It's kind of a general purpose word. But if we think of it within psychology as how kind of intelligent are you in the way that we think that humans differ in intelligence between each other, then you can start looking at some basic aspects of smartness, like what is their cognition like? What kind of memory do they have? How much can they learn and what kind of learning? And can they even do abstract reasoning? And on all of those kinds of dimensions of cognitive processes, we see that pigeons, when they've been studied on these, show strong abilities across the board.
Mm-hmm. Lauren, when we're marveling at specific tasks a bird is good at, like singing, navigation, or problem solving, do all of these map back to specific parts of the brain being better developed, like the hippocampus and navigational skills?
Yeah, that's a good question. And it's very, yeah, people are interested in looking at that. So, for example, the hippocampus is the best studied brain area for its role in spatial cognition in birds. So it's larger in homing pigeons, which, you know, they develop these amazing navigational maps that they use to find their way home from locations they've never been before. And chickadees and scrub jays, they cache seeds, and their hippocampus is larger. And even female cowbirds, that they don't put eggs in their own nests. They have to put them in other birds' nests, so they have to keep track of all these spatial locations of nests. Even they have larger hippocampi with more neurons. So yeah, definitely, you know, people are really interested in what brain areas regulate these different amazing abilities.
So where did that bird brain stereotype come from in the first place, Lauren or Aaron?
Okay, I'm happy to start that a little bit. Sure. So it was known that, I mean, if you look at a bird brain, first of all, it is smooth. It's not wrinkled like a mammalian brain. If you look at the layers of the bird brain, you don't see distinct layers, actually. It's just not organized the same way as a mammal brain. So it was thought that, you know, by flying, birds gave up. Flying, you need to be light, and they thought this means that your brain has to be smaller. And then when people named brain structures in the brain, they'd call them things like paleo, as if they were old. And when they named structures in the mammal brain, they'd call them neo, as if they were new. And so it wasn't until we started looking more closely at neurochemicals, the way the brain's organized, and counting neurons, that we realized the bird brain is much more complicated than we first thought.
I was really struck by the New Caledonia crows about how smart they are at making tools. Explain to our listeners just how smart they are.
Well, I've kind of read a lot of the literature and following that for many years about the New Caledonian crows. And crows are a member of the corvid family, and corvids in general, so corvids includes other kind of crows, rooks, and jays. They tend to be really smart. We've recognized for a long time that they seem to be able to solve problems better than other birds. But the New Caledonian crows are just even an order of magnitude smarter, seemingly. They can make their own tools. So they're in this small island, New Caledonia, in the South Pacific, and they've been shown to either take twigs and bend them into hook shapes or to cut the pandanus leaves, which big broad leaves, into stepped tools like a saw. And then they use these tools to reach into crevices that their bills cannot reach all the way into. And they pull out grubs and other kind of critters to eat.
And the other thing about that is once birds learn a new tool, they can teach other birds? That's amazing.
Yeah, I wasn't so sure about the teaching part because teaching specifically has, by definition, involves the teacher intentionally trying to shape the behavior of the pupil. And my understanding from what I've read is that in animals, this is almost non-existent, pretty rare. But what I think the New Caledonian crows do is offer the young the opportunity to observe the adults using the tools, and they can learn through that observation.
So, Lauren, your work got a mention in the book, and one of the things that we're asking in the course of looking at your research, for example, is are birds enjoying what they're doing, or why are they singing? How does one interrogate that question in the first place?
Right. So I think that's a really interesting question. And it is clear why birds are singing in some contexts and what reinforces it. So it's clear that males are going to sing courtship song to attract mates. And if they attract a mate, that's reinforcing. But they also sing in other contexts that aren't as well studied. So right now, you're going to start seeing birds like starlings forming large flocks. And we know that they sing a lot in these flocks and that it is actually really important for them to practice their songs. Starlings learn songs throughout their lives. But it's not clear why in an immediate sense that they're singing. And I looked through some of the literature and I was surprised to see that Darwin actually proposed that maybe in these contexts birds are singing because it feels good. He says that they're singing for their own amusement. And there is evidence for that. So for example, in starlings, we found that if birds are singing in these flocks, they develop a preference for where they were singing in those flocks. Just like you might develop a preference for a place where you had a positive experience, you know, like a good meal in a restaurant, for example.
Well, let's go to the phones because there's so many people who want to talk about this. So let's go to Kathy in Indiana. Hi, Kathy.
Hi.
Hi, go ahead.
So my question is, I live in northern Indiana, and last summer we heard a bird that sounded like a blaster, like a science fiction blaster being charged and then fired. And it sounded like this. Whoop, 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 pew, pew, pew. And no one can tell me what it is.
You want to do that again?
Yeah, it sounds like this. Whoop, 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 pew, pew, pew.
Okay, maybe we can get it identified. Let's, Aaron, Lauren, got any idea?
I'm not very good with bird calls. So Lauren, do you have any experience with that?
Yeah, I am not sure I'm quite getting that. It's not unfamiliar, but yeah, I'm not an ornithologist, although I do know more about birds than other people. So the pew, 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 I'm not sure what you're listening to.
Yeah, it was very strange, and several of us heard it. I didn't know, is there a way to get online? Is there any kind of website that would do sound recognition that we could look it up?
That's a good question. I know there are apps now that have been made available for music or even for speech that do that, but I've never thought to look in the space for bird call recognition song, but that'd be a great tool. I don't know of any.
Yeah. I think people are working on birdsong apps that can do that. And you can definitely go on websites like the Cornell Lab of Ornithology and play back the songs of birds that are living in your area, and you could probably identify that bird.
I have a question for everyone, actually, before we go back into research questions. Since this is a book that gave us a really wonderful broad survey of all kinds of ways in which birds are smart and all the cool things they do, I did want to see if anyone has a new favorite bird after reading this book, or even just a new appreciation for a bird that they didn't appreciate before. Ira, I'm going to let you go first.
Well, I started watching. Interesting thing, after reading the book, I started watching for smart birds or smart actions of birds. And I saw some social actions of birds that were described in the book about how they deal with each other. But my favorite bird, maybe it's because it's taken me so long to get it into my feeder, is still my hummingbirds. And what was surprising about the hummingbirds, which were, you know, talked about in the book, is that they come back. They come back every year to the feeder, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, they know where it is and they come for the food. Is that right, Lauren?
That is right.
Did anyone, Aaron, did you get a new favorite, or are you still stuck on pigeons?
Well, pigeons, actually, even though I study pigeons, they've not always been my favorite bird, although since studying them, they've become one of my favorites. Hummingbirds are actually still one of my favorites, yeah. But mm-hmm. I think reading the book, what I found new appreciation for two, one that has been a long-term favorite, but I even more respect for now, and that's the mockingbird. Mm-hmm. Incredible diversity of mm-hmm. within an individual of how plastic the song is. That is how much it can change and adopt the sounds that it hears and really mimic them to such a great extent. Mm-hmm. And the other was the bowerbird. Oh my God, I knew about bowerbirds, but by reading the book, I didn't realize quite how intense the competition was between males for attracting a female as a mate. And two, just the sheer complexity of some of these bowers.
I'm Ira Flato. This is Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
Lauren, your favorite bird?
All right. I think that's an impossible question. I do study starlings, and I know that ornithologists would be screaming because they're invasive and they're kicking out native bird populations, they're agricultural pests, but I do have a strong appreciation for them. However, if I had to think of my favorite bird, I actually came up with a backyard bird, which is the cardinal. So I think they're beautiful. I love the male's red plumage. I love the female's kind of her tan and gray plumage. They both sing. Females sing on the nest. Males are feeding the females while they're sitting on the nest. I think they're gorgeous in summer. And then in snow, which I'm in Wisconsin, right, we have really rough winters. Those gorgeous cardinals, I think, are a really nice bright spot for me.
Yeah, I've got them in my backyard, too. And, you know, it seems like they run in families. Am I right about that? There seems to be six or eight at one time.
Well, I think it depends what time of year, because they definitely don't tolerate other birds very well, but they will, you know, you'll have a male-female pair in your backyard, and then you might be observing their offspring. And then in fall, they become a little more socially tolerant when they're not defending breeding territories. So there at your feeder, you may observe, you know, a small flock of cardinals.
Mm-hmm. Does social behavior make a bird smart? I mean, this is one thing that Ackerman talks about in her explorations, but is there an intelligence to hanging out with other birds?
Well, I think that there can be. This is the social intelligence hypothesis, which has also been used to understand human intelligence. There is some support for it, and then there's some support that it's more of a technical intelligence, and both of those kinds of approaches have been covered in the book. Mm. And I think you can look at examples, and coming back to the bowerbird, actually, that's one example where intelligence seems to have been shaped by sexual selection, that is, by females choosing the males that could produce the best bowers, the most symmetrical, that have the best songs and dances to accompany them. And they also tend to scale with brain size, which is kind of a proxy for intelligence. So the bowerbirds that build the most elaborate nests and have the most elaborate displays tend to have the relatively larger brains within that group of birds than the smaller ones.
Let me see if I can get a quick phone call in from Oregon. Hi, welcome to Science Friday. Hi there, go ahead.
Hi,
quickly, please.
So this morning when I got home, my yard was full of bird sounds, and then I noticed there's a little bird stuck in my woodshed window. And I went and I grabbed it and got it outside, and then like all the rest of the birds, the crows, the hummingbirds, the quails, everybody calmed down.
So they were all watching as if they knew it was rescued.
Yeah.
Wow. Is that true? Yeah, Lauren, you know?
Well, that is interesting. I mean, I've definitely read studies where if a bird is in distress and they have heart rate monitors on other birds nearby, that their heart rate goes up even higher than it would in response to thunder. So birds will definitely respond to the distress of another individual.
We're going to come back and talk lots more with Christy Taylor, Aaron Blaisdell, and Lauren Readers. Our number 844-724-8255. Call us about your bird experiences. Also, you can tweet us at SciFry. We'll be right back with more on the brilliance of birds after this break. You're listening to Science Friday. I'm Ira Flato. We're finishing up our summer book club pick, Jennifer Ackerman's The Genius of Birds. And I know that if you've been listening, how smart and talented they really are. I mean, you'll learn a lot from this book. With my guests, Dr. Aaron Blaisdell and Dr. Lauren Readers. And here to take us along the way is Christy Taylor, our book nerd on this one.
Book bird nerd. So Lauren, one of the things that this book talks about too is you know, you're interrogating bird enjoyment of things, and one of the things we talk about is bird play. So, you know, there are these famous crow videos of crows like sliding down and sledding on things, on roofs, for example, and parrot owners, they know they need a lot of toys to stay happy. But like, why is play so important, and how do we even know if this is like about enjoyment or just a random behavior trait?
Right. So I was definitely interested in the play part. Do birds do things just for fun? And you know, when you think of play, you know, it's synonymous with fun, which makes it seem not very serious. But I think that this is, you know, an important topic. So play develops physical skills, cognition, social skills, and these are skills that birds need to use later in more serious situations. And so the book includes some famous examples that you've mentioned, playing parrots, and kias are basically destroying towns in New Zealand because they play so hard. You've got ravens playing catch, crows sledding. But given the impressive cognitive skills we see in birds, I was surprised to see that it's often said that about 1% of the 10,000 bird species play. But I actually think, based on some of my research, you know, does it feel good to sing? I think that we could add 4,000 songbirds to that list. Because when they are learning or practicing song, I propose they're playing because they're trying out different songs. They're sequencing and reseeking elements, they're basically riffing. And so there is evidence that this type of singing is pleasurable. And so I think that, you know, we can say those birds are playing as well. And we even have some evidence that it could be rewarded by endogenous opioids, which is something that you also see for play.
Let's go to the phones to California. Linda, hi. Welcome to Science Friday.
Oh, great. It just came back in. It was cutting out for a while. Hi.
Hi, go ahead.
Hello.
Linda, go ahead.
I wanted to... We have jays in our backyard, and one of them in particular has come back several years in a row. We have a big bird feeder, and he will land on it and shake it, and then he'll fly up on the fence and let the starlings and the finches and things come and eat the grain on the ground, and he never eats it. And I thought, is he doing this out of the goodness of his heart, or I don't know. I kind of feel that he does that because of that. Or yeah, it's male because it's blue. We have a creek behind us, and there's plenty of food over there. So is this a behavior that birds are known for?
Aaron, is this an altruistic bird?
Good question. These anecdotes are very tricky to interpret because you don't know what the reason is that the bird started doing this behavior. But there's some evidence for altruism in the sense, in among birds as well as mammals, but in the sense that it tends to be something that's reinforced to some degree. So there's often maybe when the bird had started, this jay had started doing this and it brought other birds, maybe there was something that happened at that first few times that reinforced this jay's behavior, and now it's kind of learned to do this. It's very tricky, but definitely there are a lot of interspecies interactions, both communication and non-communicative interactions in birds.
Let me give you my $64 question I ask all the time. If you were to study birds, and what don't you know that you would most like to know, and if what kind of equipment would you need on my blank check, which I don't have for you?
$64 whole dollars.
Shucks. Lauren, right. Do you want to answer that first?
Oh, that is an impossible question. There's so many interesting questions. So I think one thing is just it's really hard to know what the birds are perceiving and what they're experiencing. So, what would be the question that I would ask? Aaron, if you have something while we're thinking about this,
I didn't mean to put you on the spot on that. I just thought
we're both on the spot, but I could jump in.
Is there something about imaging bird brains or learning about the structure of their brains or how they work or anything like that?
I think the how they work, like getting inside the mind of an animal. That's what I do for a living, and it is tough work because it's really you deriving inferences from the behavior and even imaging neural activity, the brain in action while a bird's doing something, is still the behavior of populations of neurons. So it's giving you indirect evidence to what they're experiencing from their own point of view. But nevertheless, those are the steps, that the closest steps we can take, I think, if I had a nice big check, it would be to add imaging, real detailed type of imaging of the brain while they're doing these complex interactions, like the New Caledonian crows, and see what's going on there that we can then compare to how human brains also work, and we can extrapolate from that.
This actually brings to mind a question that I have had, Lauren and Aaron, and we're having an event in New York City actually next week where our audience members get to test themselves against some of the same problems that we know birds are really good at, like remembering where they hid lots and lots of food. But is it really fair to compare birds and humans? Can we learn, you know, is that fair? Can we learn anything?
Yeah.
Or are they completely different kinds of intelligence? I don't know, Lauren, you go first.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, so, you know, we have a hard time measuring animal minds because we can't perceive things that they perceive. We don't even have the sensory capacity. You know, in some cases, we can't hear song the way they do. We can't see feather color the way they do. And so we want to interview a bird, but to do so, we need to ask the right questions, you know, that make sense to birds, and you need to give the right species the right test. It's got to be tough, but not too tough. And often this means you have to make the test ecologically valid. So asking birds about what they do in their natural environment. And so then if a bird flunks the test, you have to consider the possibility that it's really your test failed the bird because maybe you're human bias.
I got a lot of calls coming in. Let's see how many we can get in. Let's go to Minneapolis and Jim. Hi, Jim. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi there.
Hi, go ahead.
Well, first of all, I have a wild guess that the person who called in earlier with the pew, pew, pew bird call, that sounds a lot like a blue jay alarm call to me. So she might want to check some of those on that Cornell Lab of Ornithology website. They have a set of sounds you can download. My question is about counting. Can you talk about birds' counting skills and arithmetic skills? Which birds are good at it, and why would they have evolved the ability to do counting and mathematics?
Good question.
That's an excellent question. And there's two species in particular in which this has been studied most extensively. One, of course, is the pigeon, which is very easy to study in the laboratory using our typical behavioral techniques. And pigeons do show this ability to order items based on like how many are in the set. So they'll pick one and then two and then three and then four. And after they learn to pick an order of items, one, two, three, four, you can give them five versus seven. They've never seen either before, and they'll pick the correct ordering of those numbers. And parrots also can do these kinds of things, of course, even more extensively than pigeons.
Wow. Here's a tweet coming in from MSM on Twitter. Says, I live in South Florida. Through observation, I can recognize when there is a bird of prey in the area. All of the birds sound an alarm and a call that is very distinct. Different species will call out at the same time. Do they understand each other? That's great. Is one species or one kind of bird signaling to everybody, or how does that work?
Well, birds definitely eavesdrop on other birds and take advantage of, you know, they'll hear another bird's signal and they will definitely respond. And so some birds will call when they see a predator. Starlings, they go silent. So if we're observing birds and they go silent, we know a hawk has shown up. But other birds definitely tap into the information, social information provided by other birds.
We've got lots of calls. Let's go to Marjorie in Saugerties, New York. Hi, Marjorie. Marjorie, are you there?
Yes.
Go for it.
Can
you? You must be on a cell phone or close. Oh, okay. We're going to have to drop Marjorie. Well, she had an interesting question about ravens and how smart ravens were. So that's made abundantly clear in this book, Lauren, isn't it? Ravens are how smart they are.
Oh, yeah. The ravens are incredible. I mean, there's so many examples of the ravens. They are, the whole corvid family, hiding food, making tools, deception. They're involved in deception. The way they open food, you know, dropping nuts onto streets so that cars can roll over them. I mean, it's amazing some of the things that they can do.
I feel like I need to break in and speak for non-corvid birds for a second because they are very popular and we talk about them a lot on this show and they're definitely very smart. But we had Stephen on in our Facebook group mentioned that he actually has a different nominee for smartest bird if we're going to rank them. He said the corvids are hard to beat, yet the ability of many species to navigate very long distances is mind-blowing. We love to feed hummingbirds. Their antics can be very entertaining. And these tiny birds migrate such long distances. Also, the ability of homing pigeons to return to a home roost is also legendary.
And that so reflects a tweet that David says, how do birds, or for that matter, know how to find their way without a map and return to the exact same spot, such as a migration? How do they know that?
Well, there's a combination of many different kind of skills that they might use. And, for example, the homing pigeon, they use, if they're far from home, they'll use kind of large global cues, like where the sun is and where the stars might be if they're flying at night, or even odor trails, odor gradients, so they can smell downwind or upwind, kind of a more familiar location. But then, and they'll use that to get their bearings and get their direction. As you get closer to where their home is, they'll start using things like visual cues, landmarks that are familiar to them. And so what's amazing is some birds, like the pigeon, can use a wide variety of cues. Others, like the indigo bunting that travels hundreds or thousands of kilometers, use like the North Star.
Wow. Let's get an interesting sidebar question from Bill in Cleveland. Hi, Bill.
Hello, how are you?
Fine, go ahead.
Okay, first question is, can we actually trace bird lineages? I mean, birds are a dinosaur lineage, and I read too recently that the modern orders of birds actually came into existence before the KT boundary happened. Has there been any genetic experimentation or reading done to find out where maybe the first original modern bird came from? Second, favorite bird, boat-tailed grackle. They're smart and they're generalists.
All right, do we have any knowledge about the lineage of birds? When did the first bird start? Anybody know? When was the bird a bird?
It's thought that, you know, birds and mammals diverged from a common reptilian ancestor over 300 million years ago. And they are doing a lot of genetic studies looking at the genomes of different birds, and they're kind of surprised they're smaller than most other animals, smaller than most mammals, and it's thought maybe that has to do with flight, like everything's smaller because of flight. And I thought it was really interesting to note, and this was also in the book, that turkeys are thought to be one of the most closely related to dinosaurs. And so that's easy. You know, when I'm looking at them walking around my backyard, you can see sort of these reptilian, actually, you know, dinosaur-like features as they go around.
Mm-hmm. I'm Ira Flato. This is Science Friday from WNYC Studios. Talking about birds with Aaron Blaisdell and Dr. Lauren Readers and Christy Taylor.
Well, and since we talked about the past of birds, let's talk about the future for a second. The last chapter mm-hmm. of the book looks at what is maybe the best adapted bird for this human-dominated era we're in, and maybe it is the house sparrow, which we see everywhere. They are apparently smarter than pigeons in some ways. They seem to have this novelty-seeking behavior that makes them really well adapted to cities. Lauren, you found this actually kind of depressing in the long run, right?
Well, I did. I thought this was an important chapter, the last chapter of the book, but it was kind of the buzzkill chapter because each chapter you're introduced to one fascinating example of bird genius after another, you know, in all these species. And it's clear by the end of the book that birds are highly interconnected with the rhythms of the planet. So they time their breeding and migration to closely match, you know, seasonal changes in temperature, the photoperiod, the availability of insects and plants and flowing water. And, you know, there's an example of the red knot that, you know, they need to time migration perfectly to match mm-hmm. horseshoe crab eggs. So the changes we're making to the planet disrupt the synchrony. So the plants and insects may not be available when birds need them. And what that means is a lot of these cool species, they're at risk, except the most flexible, which would be the sparrows, crows, maybe starlings, but even, you know, yeah, pigeons. And, you know, they're fascinating. But the book really, I thought, created awareness about the interconnectedness of the birds and what we have to lose if we don't, you know, watch what we're doing and take care of our planet.
Because, Bert, are you saying that climate change really is affecting the birds?
Yeah, well, the climate change can throw out of sync the availability of the resources that the birds need to breed. You know, and you're changing temperature, so some species that are living on mountains are having to move further and further up the mountains, right, so that they can exist at temperatures that work for them, and they're running out of space. So, yeah, climate change, I think, is a real problem for these birds.
Mm-hmm. Aaron, are you optimistic about the future of birds?
Well, I agree with Lauren and with the book that it's really a dire situation for the number of different species. But if you take the longer range view, I like to balance it out a little bit, the stoic in me, to balance out the longer range view is that even after the catastrophic event of the dinosaur mass extinction, it allowed such a radiation of mammals and birds. And whatever, you know, mass extinction we're going to cause, I like to think that the life will recover, become variable and diverse again, as much as I'm weeping about the current loss of diversity.
One last Twitter question is, what is the frequency range? What frequency are they birds sensitive to? What do they hear?
You mean hearing?
Yeah. Is it, you know, is it above the range? Like we always see dog whistles, they're above our hearing, or are they...
That depends on the species. Lauren, you might know more about that, but I know some birds really can hear really high levels and some in the infrasound.
Yeah. So a lot of the frequency range is similar to ours, but some can hear out of the frequency range. And then they also are adjusting the frequency. So, you know, this is a thing we're talking about, the climate and how, you know, there's noise disturbance. And so birds will adjust their vocalizations, singing at different frequencies to try to avoid noise pollution that we've introduced.
We've run out of time. So much to talk about, so little time. As always, Dr. Aaron Blaisdell, professor of psychology at UCLA. Dr. Lauren Readers, professor of neuroscience, University of Wisconsin in Madison. And of course, sci-fi producer and book club captain, Christy Taylor.
Thank you so much, Ira.
You're all
Thank
welcome.
You, Ira.
Yeah. Until
Thank
next
you.
Time, keep on reading. And if you're, hey, we're not quite through yet, because if you're in New York, come to our Brainy Bird Party next week at Caveat, August 29th. Caveat August 29th. Details and tickets on sciencefriday.com/birdbrain. Charles Berkowitz is our director, senior producer, Christopher Intagliata. Our producers are Alexa Lim, Christy Taylor, and Katie Feather. Today we had a production help from Lucy Wong, and our intern is Camille Peterson. Technical engineering help from Rich Kim and Kevin Wolf. BJ Lederman composed our theme music, and of course we're active all week on social media, Instagram, Twitter, wherever. You know, if you have a smart speaker, you can ask it to play Science Friday whenever you want to. So every day now is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.